Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
On behalf of my colleagues in the College of Letters and Science, Deans Melvin Oliver, Pierre Wiltzius, and Mary Nisbet, I'm very pleased to welcome you to this year's Arthur N. Roop Great Debate, in which our two distinguished speakers, Scott Horton and Stuart Taylor, will address the topic, Torture and the Law, Can U.S. Officials Be Held Accountable? Now, as many of you know, over the years, the Arthur N. Roop Great Debate series has addressed many issues of national and international significance through the presentation of diverse viewpoints. It's been a privilege to get to know Art Roop over the years and to see the results of his commitment to intelligent public dialogue. Mr. Roop understands that democracy in America depends on informed citizens and a public sphere in which we can debate ideas and test beliefs. If today's culture of talk radio, cable television, 24-hour news cycles, and an ever-expanding blogosphere, it's crucial that we have informed and intelligent dialogue about the issues that divide us as well as the issues that bring us together. Helping to make such a dialogue possible is the responsibility of a great public university and the contribution of our liberal arts education. So with my thanks to Arts and Lectures and our college staff and, of course, the Roop Foundation, I'd like to introduce Professor Lisa Hajar, the organizer and the moderator of tonight's debate. Professor Hajar, chair of the Law and Society program, is a scholar on such topics as human rights and international law and the Middle East. She will introduce our speakers and tonight's Arthur N. Roop Great Debate. So thank you and welcome.
Great turnout. I, too, want to begin by thanking Arthur Roop and the Roop Foundation. I've attended all of the debates since I started teaching here in 2001, and they're an amazing opportunity, as David had just said, for civic debate on important issues. Just a few other thanks. I would like to thank the College of Letters and Sciences and Roman Baratiak, who runs the Arts and Lecture Series. Yay. With such a plum. Couldn't live without Roman. I'd also like to note the idea of this debate. UCSB has been doing torture, if we can say, for a while. And in particular, last year we organized, a few of us organized, I think, a wonderful series on torture and the future. And we now have, there's a torture research focus group that has continued this discussion. I would just like to also acknowledge my co-convener on that, Elizabeth Weber from the Department of German, Slavic, and Semitic Studies and Comparative Literature. Bravo, Elizabeth. And so, in a sense, torture and the future, last year we were very much in the midst of dealing with stories as they were unfolding. One thing I would say about the debate and this timing with the new administration coming on is the future is now. And that's what the subject of our debate will be. I just wanted to maybe quote a little bit or cite a little bit about how absolutely debatable and divided the very question at issue on tonight's discussion is. According to a Washington Post ABC News poll that came out just 2 weeks ago, a majority of Americans oppose the use of torture. But there's an even split in this country over whether the Obama administration should pursue criminal investigations into law violations by the Bush administration. Overall, 58% of Americans support the prohibition of torture, but there's a wide gap across party lines. 71% of Democrats and 56% of independents say torture should never be used. But 55% of Republicans say there are cases in which torture should be considered against terror suspects. And there's also a very large divide, specifically on tonight's topic, about accountability. 69% of Democrats say they'd like to see criminal investigations, while 69% of Republicans said no. And independents divide 53 to 45% against investigations, And so put all together, Americans break 50% in favor of investigations and 47% opposed. So we'll see how the audience tonight thinks about these issues. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce our two debaters. I'll introduce Stuart Taylor first, although he'll speak second, and Scott Horton, I will introduce second, he'll speak first. Stuart Taylor is a weekly opinion columnist for the National Journal, a contributing editor for Newsweek, and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He worked as a journalist for the Baltimore Sun for several years after college and then decided to go to law school. He went to Harvard, and when he graduated, he practiced law with Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering from 1978 to 1980. And then he decided to go back to his calling now with a law degree and joined the New York Times Washington Bureau in 1980, where for the next almost decade, he covered legal affairs and the Supreme Court. Since leaving the New York Times in 1988, he's written commentary and in-depth magazine articles for the American Lawyer, Legal Times, and for the National Journal and Newsweek since 1998. And his first book, which came out in September, co-authored by Casey Johnson, is Until Proven Innocent, Political Correctness and the Shameful Injustice of the Duke LaCrosse Rape Case. So actually, Stuart, do you want to come out and sit on this? Thank you. I forgot to mention, during the moderated part of the debate, cards will be passed out for people to write questions, and then they will be gathered up, and we will take the questions. And now I will introduce Scott Horton, who's been a human rights advocate for more than 30 years. He launched his career working for democracy advocates in Czechoslovakia, East Germany, and the Soviet Union. He now serves as a director of the Moscow-based Andrei Sakharov Foundation. He's also been involved in human rights probes, many of which focused on torture accusations in Central Asia, the Caucasus, North and West Africa, El Salvador, Peru, and Mexico. In the 1990s, Scott also worked as a commercial lawyer handling foreign investments in Central Asia. He's one of the founding members of the American University of Central Asia, and he currently is an adjunct professor at Columbia University, where he teaches the laws of armed conflict. Since 2002, Scott headed two major Bar Association reports addressing the legality of interrogation techniques and the Extraordinary Rendition Program. He's a contributing editor for Harper's Magazine, where he writes the blog No Comment, and he wrote the December cover story, Justice After Bush. And he also writes monthly columns for The American Lawyer and contributes to the Los Angeles Times and The New Republic. So give a welcome to Scott.
Well, good evening. And I want to extend my thanks to the College of Letters and Science and to the organizers who set up this event, but also particularly to the Arthur N. Roop Foundation for the idea of this debate series, which I think it's certainly a treat for me to be able to participate in it, but also I think a great thing for the university and the university community. And I also want to say thanks to Lisa and to Roman, who really made this a pleasure from the beginning. I spoke here about 2 years ago, and I just remember the warm welcome and hospitality from the UCSB community, and when this offer came, it took me about 10 seconds to decide that, yes, I was going to drop all my classes at the end of the week and accept. It really is a pleasure to be here. In fact, coming here is something of an inspiration. I made the drive up here today from Los Angeles, and coming on the highway, I almost caused a major accident when I saw this breathtaking vista of the Channel Islands. And it made me think for a moment about Jonathan Swift and his Gulliver's Travels. If you think back to that book, one of my favorite books from childhood, but I think later I came to realize it was very, very serious work. You'll recall that Swift's hero, Lemuel Gulliver, has a curious geography. It's a combination of the real world and the fantastic. But one of the most amazing parts of the book, the second part in particular, involves a very particular geography. He tells us that he travels to the kingdom of Brobdingnag, and he tells us specifically where it's located. It's an island off the coast of California. And it occurred to me this morning as I was driving here, well, here we are. This must be the kingdom of Brobdingnag that he tells us about. And it struck me immediately, this has some significance for our discussion today, the issues. And in this particular part of the book, Gulliver visits with the king of this paradisical island kingdom that has also the associated mainland. So Santa Barbara, we can say, must be right in the middle of this kingdom. And the king tells him that he values lawyers very much. He values them based on their usefulness. He says, the best lawyers are those who can show that black is white. And he says, laws are best explained, interpreted, and applied by those whose interest and abilities lie in perverting, confounding, and eluding them. Now, the king places stock in these lawyers because they allow him to rule above the law. He can use it as a tool to achieve his will, but he's not beholden to it. His kingdom, we learned from Swift, is ruled by man and not by law. Swift's book isn't just for children, of course. In fact, it's a ferocious piece of political satire, bitter at some points. And the point he's making has a lot to do with the problem we face today. What do we do with a government that twists the words and purposes of the law beyond recognition, establishing the principle that it is a government of men, not of laws? Not a laughing matter. And from Swift's perspective, all of history appears to be a struggle for the rule of law and for government of principle. It's been a struggle to hold the high and mighty to account before the law. Swift is right about another thing. The past dictates our present. We are its captives. And the attitudes we adopt towards our immediate past will dictate our future. Some will want to turn the page and move on, leave the matter for historians and journalists to work out, and indeed, politicians close to President Bush and individuals deeply enmeshed in programs like the highly coercive interrogation program and the terrorist surveillance program fervently hope that that's exactly what we're going to do. But I think the public in the United States is gradually moving in a different direction. In addition to the poll that Lisa cited, which was Washington Post, ABC News poll, we also have a still more recent poll conducted by USA Today that showed roughly by a 2-to-1 margin, Americans want to see some form of accountability with respect to these matters that occurred over the last 8 years. They do not want to see the book simply closed and to move on. I believe that there are several steps to be taken. The first of these is that we should know the truth, that it should fully be revealed, that this is a part of our democratic franchise. It's essential to our society. But the real issue is what kind of country we will have going forward. It is whether the transgressions that occurred in the course of the last 8 years will be accepted as just another policy option that a future president can turn to utilizing the same tools. So if we turn the page without acting, we're saying that presidents, perhaps including the current one, Barack Obama, may be free to torture prisoners with impunity, to spy on American citizens without obtaining warrants or going to Congress for authority to do so, to pick and choose between the laws as to which they will enforce and which they will ignore by issuing secret partial vetoes through appended signing statements, or by placing political hacks in the Office of Legal Counsel, the Department of Justice, to render secret opinions that turn to dust the instant they see the light of day, that tell them that they can do whatever they want to because it's lawful. That's a prospect for our future, a dark prospect. And in the end, I think, when the Bush administration launched a war on terror, it seems to have been transformed pretty quickly into a war on law and our understandings of law. Our country operates on the basis of precedent. Failing to act on the Bush legacy means that these acts, no matter how outrageous or illegal we may think they are accepted as precedents. I don't think it would be appropriate or even possible to investigate and deal with all the abuses of the last 8 years. In fact, I think one has to start sorting through them and pull out those which present the greatest concern. And for me, it's really policies that were developed to deal with detainees that were most troubling. There are three areas of particular concern I focus on. The first is the interrogations program, which John Yoo, University of California law professor, the author of the infamous torture memoranda, properly calls the Bush program. We have a system of techniques that were introduced by the Bush administration over sustained objection from career lawyers, particularly military lawyers. One, for instance, now a senior general in the Pentagon, recounted to me in detail his conversations with John Yoo, in which he told you that the techniques under contemplation and approved by you were violations of U.S. law, that they would be crimes, and that they would lead to criminal prosecutions. You, he said, responded by saying that, of course, he was concerned about the issue of criminal accountability. This was a principal concern, but this had been addressed because he had taken the issue up with the head of the criminal division at the Department of Justice in the process of preparing his opinion. Second, we have a system of extraordinary renditions that was created under which persons could be seized and transported to secret prisons outside of any accountability under law and then regularly tortured either by U.S. agents or by foreign states acting as our proxies. Third, we have a system of military commissions created in Guantanamo, an unprecedented judicial travesty. Six prosecutors resigned or requested transfer after disclosing that they were aware of efforts by political figures to rig the proceedings or to assure outcomes that were acceptable to the administration. And I know from interviewing them that there were four other prosecutors who did not, prosecutors, mind you, who did not resign, but were prepared to do so had there not been a stand-down order for the commissions. And this placed an unprecedented taint on the American military justice system, which previously was a point of pride for our country. Three programs that I've just described violated criminal law in a systematic way. The violations occurred as a matter of policy that was formed by government and pushed through over the objections of career employees, including lawyers. Now, President Obama has swept away the most offensive aspects of these programs in a series of executive orders he issued in his first 2 days in office. Attorney General Eric Holder testified that he considered specific authorized techniques to be unlawful. Specifically, he said he considered waterboarding, which President Bush noted was applied with his authority to three prisoners to be torture, which is a felony under U.S. criminal law. More importantly, Susan J. Crawford, a protege of Vice President Cheney's, who was appointed through the connivance of David Addington, Cheney's chief of staff, as the senior administrating official operating the Guantanamo commissions, told Bob Woodward in an interview that she had examined the case of one detainee, who was not waterboarded, by the way, but was subjected to a complex regimen of sensory deprivation and overload, sleep deprivation, sexual humiliation, and so forth. And she concluded that he was tortured. She therefore said she would not approve the charge sheet. Well, according to the testimony of Lieutenant General Mark Schmidt before the Senate Armed Services Committee, this particular detainee had been interrogated with the direct involvement of the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, who had overseen the program in detail. Well, under U.S. law and under international law, this points to a crime. Torture is a violation of the criminal code. It's also an international law crime. And under Articles 4, 5, and 7 of the Convention Against Torture, of which the United States is a party, but that's really understates it. The Convention Against Torture wouldn't exist without U.S. sponsorship and promotion. It is essentially a convention that enacts American values and views as international law. The U.S. committed itself to conduct a criminal investigation of any credible allegation of torture, and also to make torture a crime, which was done by the enactment of the anti-torture statute. So, notwithstanding this statement by Judge Crawford, there is no open investigation now of the torture allegation. That constitutes a breach in and of itself of this important international agreement. In fact, officials of the United Nations and at least one of our NATO allies has already admonished the Obama administration that it appears to be in breach of its obligations under this convention because it has not opened a criminal investigation. Why did the Bush administration not investigate these matters? Well, we know that Michael Mukasey, the Attorney General, who, by the way, was my law partner, my friend of more than 20 years, stated that these matters were all covered by opinions that were issued by the Office of Legal Counsel, that administration officials were entitled to rely on these opinions, and that therefore no crime could have occurred. But I think this view is not tenable. There isn't a right of counsel defense under the anti-torture statute. Neither is there such a defense under the Convention Against Torture. In fact, torture as a crime is non-derogable, one of the few prohibitions of international law that fits in that category. But moreover, what's essentially being argued is that there's something like a doctrine of promissory estoppel. I don't want to get too much into legal technical matters, but that means essentially the Justice Department told me I could do this. The Justice Department cannot now turn around and come and prosecute me. That's what we call an equitable defense. And traditionally, these defenses have to be examined in all their particulars. All the circumstances and facts around them would have to be probed to determine whether the person raising this claim is doing so in good faith and, you know, whether he has acted equitably or not. And I think when that examination occurs, the defense collapses. We're going to be hearing a lot more about this issue soon. In fact, Stewart's publication, Newsweek, has already published an article. Michael Isikoff wrote it. In fact, I spoke with Michael repeatedly as he was researching it and putting it together, that reflects an ethics investigation within the Department of Justice has been completed, dealing with these torture memoranda that President Bush and Vice President Cheney said they relied upon, and it articulates blistering criticism of these memoranda on the merits. But it also looks at the facts of how they came to be created. And I think when it comes out, we're going to see that the program, the Bush program, was already in place, was already implemented, and John Yoo and his colleagues were asked to craft memoranda that would cover them, would provide a defense. This is what Jack Goldsmith called in his book, The Terror Presidency, a golden shield that would defend against criminal liability. But if these facts are sustained, as I suspect they will be, we're going to discover that this golden shield is made out of fool's gold. It really doesn't work. We're in a democratic society. The people have a right to be informed about what was done in their name, and launching a criminal investigation and perhaps also a prosecution seems to me an unavoidable step, but it's not enough. The people have a right to know what happened. We need to establish the truth, and the best way to get there is to have a blue ribbon panel created to conduct an investigation. And this commission, I think, should best be formed along the model of the 9/11 Commission, but we need some modifications from that model. It needs to be less political than that model, which was really a bipartisan and not a nonpartisan commission. This new commission needs to be filled with professionals who are viewed as who have standing and stature above the political fray in Washington and who have key experience and careers in areas that bring them a background that can contribute to resolution of the issues that would come up. That's going to include career military personnel, a career intelligence, a diplomat, a prosecutor, a formal judge, also ethicists and human rights advocates, and I think a religious figure needs to be involved. It should investigate these issues and present a definitive narrative of what happened and present the President and Congress with a series of clear recommendations as to how to go forward. And I think it also should recommend to the Attorney General, if it finds evidence of criminal wrongdoing, as I'm sure it will, it should recommend to the Attorney General that a special prosecutor be appointed to investigate and act on those cases. What's at stake here? It's our democracy, our understanding of the relationship between institutions like the Congress and the President, avoiding a president with dictatorial powers, upholding our traditions and values, being a leader in the international community, attending effectively to our security. One thing that flows from the Bush years is a sense that our laws, our Constitution, our democratic values were a weakness that might best be supplanted with something that involved a dramatic inflation of the power of the executive. And I noticed in reading Jane Mayer's book, The Dark Side, a very interesting passage. A senior CIA figure describes his meeting with David Addington and Dick Cheney at which the legality of the black sites came up. He summarizes it this way, laws like who the F-word cares. That could stand as a motto for the last 8 years. And it presents us with a dilemma. We can agree with Nixon that if the president does it, that means it's legal. That's a dark vision of our constitutional order. Or we can hold to the view that our founding fathers had, which Thomas Paine summed up this way. In America, the law ought to be king, and there ought to be no other. Or we could view this all as a lesson in geography. Do we live today in the America that our founding fathers envisioned? Or do we live in the kingdom of Brobdingnag? Swift is right about one thing. This geography is ultimately of our making. Thank you.
Good evening. Glad to be here. I'd like to add my thanks to those of Scott, to Mr. Roop, and the Roop Foundation, to Lisa Hajar, to Roman Baratiak and to others who have helped put this event together. I'm privileged to be here. I picked up the idea at dinner that in the past there had been debates that weren't quite debates, where people tended to agree on too many things, and that it would be better on this occasion if we could kind of get a little feisty. To borrow from Johnny Cash, you know, kicking and a gouging in the mud and the blood and the beer. And it's with considerable regret that I have to concede that I agree with some things Scott said. But I'll get past those quickly and then get on to the mud and the blood and the beer. I agree with Scott that Bush was a bad president. Let's begin at the beginning. That high officials who intentionally authorized torture should be prosecuted. I don't think any did, but I'll come back to that. That the Bush interrogation policies were too brutal, in some cases led to what most people would consider torture. That also set loose a bad chain of command phenomenon that led to a lot of torture in the field by people, some of whom have been prosecuted for torture already under military law. I agree that that on some of these matters we should have a criminal investigation into whether crimes are committed, but I think it should be done the old-fashioned way by Justice Department career lawyers, not by a special prosecutor having a television show. We've had a lot of special prosecutors in this country, and we came to regret them, and that's why Congress allowed the special prosecutor law to lapse, because special prosecutors tend to bring a singularly merciless brand of justice, owing perhaps to the fact that they're appointed to get to the bottom of one case, and if they don't indict anybody, they're nothing. And so the bias is in favor of proceeding against people one way or another. On the Truth Commission idea, I once agreed with Scott on that and wrote an article to that effect. I'm not so sure I still think that for reasons I'll elaborate on. And by and large, I think in general, I'd like to note, as one who voted for President Obama, that the effort that is now underway by many, many groups, human rights groups, the ACLU, my friends at the Constitution Project and others, long, long list, and by some distinguished former military people, to get a quasi-criminal truth commission to recommend a special prosecutor, which, as Scott says, would almost be a foregone conclusion as far as these people are concerned, which kind of makes you wonder who needs a truth commission if you already know what they're going to do. But I think that it should be noted that this is a movement to pressure President Obama to do something that he apparently does not want to do. He does not, by all indications of what his public statements and Eric Holder's, the new Attorney General, they have been a little ambiguous, but I think they're most commonly read as saying, we want to look forward, we don't want to look back. Of course, if there's obvious criminality, we should prosecute it, but we don't want to have a great, big, gigantic investigation of Bush misdeeds messing up our administration, because it would tear the country apart, among other things. And let me come to some of those points. And I think it's important to focus on specifics here. There were a lot of general propositions stated that Scott made that I agree with, but when you get down to specifics, I don't think the case has been made for criminality. First, should, as the title of our talk is, Torture in the Law, Can U.S. Officials Be Held Accountable? I might note in passing that they have been held accountable, not criminally accountable, except for some low-level people who were prosecuted for torture in the field. But frankly, I'd much rather be waterboarded, and I know what waterboarding is like. I haven't done it, but I've read enough about it to have a feel. I'd a lot rather be waterboarded than see my reputation smeared the way some of the fine people I know who are on the receiving end of some of the attacks, calling them torturers and war criminals, they're already incurring large legal fees. They've been punished quite a bit. Whether they did something wrong or not, I think they made some mistakes, but it's not as though they've just been sailing along merrily without having paid any consequence for their misdeeds. If you think they've done misdeeds, they've already paid some considerable consequences. The question is whether they committed crimes for which they should prosecute. And let me read something that that President Obama said on this general subject. He noted last April the need to distinguish between, quote, really dumb policies that rise to the level of criminal activity, I'm sorry, really dumb policies and policies that rise to the level of criminal activity, implying that a lot of what has been criticized here are really dumb but not criminal, which is my view, and said that he would not want his first term consumed by what he was perceived on the part of Republicans as a partisan witch hunt. On a similar vein, David Cole, a very distinguished advocate for detainees and civil libertarian, recently wrote in the New York Review of Books that criminal prosecutions or investigations of so-called war crimes by the Bush people would be the most divisive criminal prosecutions in the history of the country. The Obama administration has a lot of very tough problems to fight, and having a civil war going on, a moral equivalent of a civil war, over whether former Bush officials should be hauled off and put in prison is a problem he doesn't need. And by the way, we're not just talking about one or two malefactors. If the logical consequences of what Scott is saying were carried to a conclusion, the following people would be in federal prison: Dick Cheney, George Bush, Donald Rumsfeld, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, George Tenet, all of their lawyers, various career CIA officials who participated in interrogations, and if you think they should all go to prison, more power to you. I think it would be one of the most grotesque injustices in the history of the United States. Injustices is what I meant to say. But before I go on, let me ask you to think about a hypothetical situation that I think has some relevance here. Suppose that your child is kidnapped and held for ransom by two evil men, not so hypothetical, who threaten to kill her unless a ransom is paid by 6 p.m. Suppose further that you take the ransom to a 3 p.m. rendezvous with one of the men. Suppose that the police had followed and arrested him on the spot. Suppose they let you sit in on the interrogation. Suppose that the man defiantly refuses to disclose your child's location through 2 hours of gentle interrogation, cajoling, warnings about the death penalty, appeals to his humanity, yelling, and threats. All the while he's laughing at the cops and at you, the parent, because you're there. Now it's 5 p.m., 1 hour before your hidden child is supposed to be murdered. The police captain starts yelling at the suspect, "I'm going to beat you to death if you don't talk." Would you tell the captain to stop using threats like that? If your answer to that is no, I wouldn't tell him to stop, then you're condoning torture as defined by the human rights groups that want to put all of the folks I mentioned earlier in jail. Moral absolutes tend to break down a little bit, unless you think, fine, let them kill my kid, doesn't work, it's inhumane, and so forth. Here are four specific reasons, and I'm going to cite a case a little later that's a little bit like the one I just, a real case, a little bit like the one I mentioned. Four specific reasons why no prosecution of any high-level official is warranted. First, I mentioned it would tear the country apart, and I've quoted what Obama said. Second, while I deplore the brutal interrogation methods that were approved at high levels, and while some detainees were certainly tortured in the usual meaning of that word by people at low levels, no evidence that high-level officials acted with criminal intent to violate either the narrowly drafted anti-torture law or any other law have been brought forward. To borrow from, I think it was Lord Talleyrand, this was worse than a crime, it was a blunder. Now, Scott said that there's no right to counsel defense or words to that effect for torture. I'd like to read a provision of the relevant law on this subject, the Detainee Treatment Act of 1985, which was passed under leadership of bipartisan leadership. Section 1004A. Congress specified that personnel involved in officially authorized and Justice Department approved detention and interrogation of suspected international terrorists cannot be convicted if they, quote, did not know that the practices were unlawful, and a person of ordinary sense and understanding would not know that the practices were unlawful. The section adds, good faith reliance on advice of counsel should be an important factor in assessing this. Now, as Scott mentioned, all of these people at high levels who approved waterboarding and other harsh interrogation techniques, they didn't approve beheading, by the way, or other things that might be more severe forms of torture, pulling fingernails, hot brands, and so forth, that all of them had been advised by the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, which is the authoritative body within the executive branch. It's basically the Supreme Court of the executive branch, that these methods used with appropriate safeguards, as in not waterboarding for 2 hours, maybe waterboarding for I'm not sure how long, were actually legal, that they did not violate the anti-torture statute. And although that may sound a little fanciful, and I think that some of those memos were wrong, you need to understand that the criminal law against torture, unlike the international law that Scott mentioned, the criminal law of the United States is very, very narrow. It doesn't say intentional infliction of pain is torture. It says severe physical pain. It doesn't say intentional infliction of mental agony is torture. It says severe mental pain or suffering, and it further defines that to mean the prolonged mental harm accompanying various practices. And that is reasonably interpreted to mean not that you were in mental agony while they were doing it for 5 minutes, but you were in mental agony for months or years thereafter. Now, you may not like that definition. I don't much like it either. I think it's unduly narrow for the common sense meaning of torture, but that's what the criminal law says. And when we're talking about the rule of law, it's relevant to look at what the law says. The law says that this is a defense. It says it quite clearly, says it quite unambiguously. I'm almost finished my opening remarks. Scott mentioned John Yoo, who wrote a much criticized torture memo that would have allowed beheading and other things. And I joined him and joined at the beginning in assailing this as an indefensible memo. However, what's less noted is that several much more respectable lawyers, including Dan Levin and others, who succeeded you after his memo has been withdrawn and repudiated by my friend Jack Goldsmith, who Scott mentioned, several others also found that the practices actually used by the CIA were legal, including waterboarding. They may have been wrong, but these were not frivolous lawyers, and they were not making a frivolous case. Third, even if a technical case could be made for prosecuting high officials, it would be unwise and unwarranted as a matter of prosecutorial discretion. Prosecutors don't prosecute every crime they hear about. They choose which ones are uniquely deserving of prosecution. And in this case, we're talking about officials who were honorably motivated. They were not doing this out of sadism. They were not doing this to punish people. They were not doing this to please their weird desires. Even those who I have very low regard for, including Rumsfeld and Cheney, were doing it because they were desperately afraid. Everyone inside the national security bureaucracies in the White House was desperately afraid in 2001, 2002, 2003, that Washington or New York might any day be incinerated by a nuclear explosion, or that there might be an anthrax attack on the subway, and that this time we might have tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of casualties, not 3,000 as we had on 9/11. And they were afraid that this would happen on their watch, and they were doing their darndest to prevent it. This affects judgment as to, well, what's torture, what's severe physical pain. It may warp judgment, but it certainly should affect judgment, the motivation for what it's done. And the question whether the brutal methods that they approved saved lives is a complicated one, but I think it's utterly clear that harsh interrogation methods have in the past in some cases and may well in this case have saved lots of lives, and I can elaborate on that later. Last point, the approach that the prosecutorial mindset advocates would destroy the ability of presidents to get good people to take on the toughest jobs and would prompt those who take the jobs to worry more about avoiding legal jeopardy than about saving lives. Consider this quotation, quote, "Lawyers at CIA sometimes have displayed a risk aversion in the advice that they give their clients. We're not living in times in which lawyers can say no to an operation just to play it safe," end quote. That wasn't Dick Cheney speaking. It was Bob Graham, a Senate Democrat, former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. That was in a hearing in 2002 in the wake of 9/11. He was basically complaining that because of fears of being hauled into court and prosecuted and attacked as war criminals, which is the kind of thing we're talking about now, the CIA had held back and others had held back, and that was among the reasons the 9/11 attacks had occurred. So when you pass judgment on the people who are trying to prevent it from happening again, you might think back a little bit to that mindset rather than the much more comfortable mindset that we have after their policies, for whatever reason, have prevented the recurrence of any terrorist violence in the United States over the last 7 years. Thanks.
So now the format is Scott can rebut Stuart briefly. Stuart can then rebut Scott's rebuttal, and then I will throw in some things, and then we'll take questions from the audience.
Well, it seems to me we should start with some discussion of confidence in process, allowing things to go forward in the normal way, and avoiding politically dictated results. Because we have people in this debate right now saying they should be prosecuted, and we have other people saying, no, they should be immune, nothing should happen. The way our system contemplates these things proceeding is when sufficient evidence arises to demonstrate a need for a criminal investigation, that criminal investigation is undertaken. And the professional prosecutor makes a judgment at the end of a day whether to bring charges or not to bring charges, going through a whole series of considerations. Did he find or she find sufficient evidence to make a case? Were there affirmative defenses? How would a jury react to this charge? So, of course, I think a lot of the issues that Stu raises wind up being perfectly legitimate considerations that play into the prosecutor's decision at the end of the day whether he's going to bring charges against specific individuals or not. But they don't constitute a reason to put on a blindfold and refuse to investigate. And indeed, that is an obligation we have now. We committed ourselves when we signed the Convention Against Torture, when we enacted the anti-torture statute, that we were going to rigorously enforce this prohibition against torture, and that we were going to conduct criminal investigations of credible evidence. Stu suggests, well, there really isn't any out there. How serious is that statement? Consider that the apex authority, Susan J. Crawford, a career Republican, a Republican ideologue, moreover, selected for that position by David Addington, who she described in a public function as her mentor, reviews a case and says,
torture occurred. That's my legal conclusion. And moreover, she goes on in that interview in the Washington Post to explain how she came to that conclusion. She said, I looked at the combination of all the things that were done to this detainee and the consequences of those things, and I said, that's torture. To me, it was striking because that was an absolutely correct application of the legal standard that's set out in the anti-torture statute, and it led to an inevitable conclusion. And this detainee was not the only detainee who was subjected to a program of this sort. So we have a judicial determination made by a judicial figure for procedural purposes that torture occurred. No criminal investigation? How serious are we about this law and this statute? Then let's look at this question of reliance on advice of counsel. First, one important point. There's a canard thrown out in this debate constantly, which says essentially, if we launch an investigation into torture, we're going to wind up holding young American service personnel who are simply implementing the policies of this administration to account. They're going to be scapegoated. To which the answer is, Bush and Rumsfeld already did that. They went after, as I count it, more than two dozen enlisted personnel, young kids, average age under 20, in connection with deeds that occurred in Abu Ghraib, Bagram, and some other installations. They scapegoated. The Detainee Treatment Act effectively does provide immunity to the balance of these ground-level personnel, particularly on the CIA side. They're not going to be prosecuted, and no, I think no career prosecutor would go after them. The issue here is the policymakers. That's the focus of the investigation. So it really is, it goes from the top. It's President Bush, Vice President Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and in fact, Susan Crawford's statement directly implicates her boss, effectively, Donald Rumsfeld, in this. He really should be a target of investigation here. And also, I think, particularly the lawyers. Probably the lawyers are the most capable, the most culpable of this entire group. So Stewart also says, there's no evidence connecting administration policy with the abuses that occurred at Abu Ghraib and Bagram. I think you excluded Guantanamo in your article in Newsweek. Is that right?
It was certainly Guantanamo. There were specific approvals of things.
And in the
other places, I don't say there's no relationship, but I say there was
no evidence.
No direct authorization. No evidence of direct authorization.
And I just ask you all to think, how credible is that statement? There is direct evidence linking these policies to the abuses that occurred. How many of you watch Taxi to the Dark Side, the Oscar award-winning documentary? I worked with Alex Gibney in putting that together. We looked at a specific case, a homicide involving a young Afghan taxi driver named Dilawar. And in putting that that film together, we, in fact, got secret film of a session, a review session, involving a group of officers chaired by an Air Force colonel investigating this case, in which the colonel states, of course, we know these tactics that were used that led to Dilawar's death resulted from rules of engagement authorized in the Pentagon, but that's all secret. We can't even allude to it. And similarly, with respect to what happened at Abu Ghraib, Major General Antonio Taguba, my friend, I think, was here speaking on campus about this. He conducted the principal investigation into what happened at Abu Ghraib. And what is his view? Yes, he saw information. He saw specific documentary evidence suggesting that that rules of engagement for harsh interrogation practices were introduced at Abu Ghraib. He even talks about one memorandum posted that bore a signature and notation on the side from Donald Rumsfeld. There's no question that there's a direct connection between these orders and what happened. And moreover, under military law, under United States law, you don't even need that evidence. We have a doctrine called command responsibility. And under that doctrine, the command authority is presumed to be liable for abuses that occur at detention facilities unless it can demonstrate that it acted promptly to remedy these abuses. These cases, there's no action to do anything before the publication in the New Yorker and on 60 Minutes of these abuses. Public pressure caused it to happen, and then the action immediately went against those individuals who caused the disclosure to occur. So I think the evidence is considerable, but in any event, a conclusion has to be drawn at the end of the day after a comprehensive investigation. And what we've seen for the last 8 years is the consistent invocation of national security classifications to cover up what occurred. Now, I happen to believe that national security classifications can be used to keep things secret and should be used to keep things secret, including, you know, military secrets and diplomatic secrets of the United States. But to use these things to conceal evidence of crime is itself a crime. And that has been going on consistently for 7 years now. It's very important to get to the bottom of what happened and establish the actual facts. And I think in the end that means a criminal investigation occurs. The criminal investigation, should it be professional, justice professionals? Yes, it should be. The independent counsel statute has lapsed. We'd now be operating under the internal rules of the Department of Justice, which authorize the Attorney General to appoint a special counsel in appropriate cases. And one of the issues that would have to be addressed here by the Attorney General is whether these issues can be adequately addressed by career professionals at the Department of Justice today. And one of the issues we have to deal with is many of these cases are going to turn on what happened at the head of the criminal division, the head of the National Security Division, and then the Office of Legal Counsel, Department of Justice. I think if we look at those regulations, Department of Justice regulations, they suggest very strongly this is a case where the Attorney General should reach outside of the department to bring someone in. It could be a retired judge. It could be a retired prosecutor. It needs to be someone who's viewed as above the political fray, but also someone who has stature to act forcefully and credibly with society.
Thanks. Well, we agree that the Justice Department should criminally investigate some of these matters. The disagreement there seems to be that I believe that President Obama, Eric Holder, his Attorney General, and their duly appointed subordinates, when they have them, are the right people to do this. Career Justice Department people, you have a new administration in power that has no stake in protecting the Bush administration, but I trust them not to persecute the Bush administration either, because I think they're wise and responsible leaders. I think what Scott really wants is the most political possible form of investigation, the so-called special counsel. And whether it's court-appointed under the old statute or the kind of special counsel that Patrick Fitzgerald was, their history teaches us that special counsels, you know, including some people who are very good lawyers when they get started, tend to end in leading political vendettas because of the dynamics of that sort of appointment and the publicity that attends it. You may have heard of Lawrence Walsh, who hounded many people into their graves practically on Iran-Contra, is widely viewed as having gotten carried away. You may have heard of Kenneth Starr, and there were several other independent counsels appointed during the Clinton administration, the preceding administration, and almost all of them seem to have gone to great excess. I don't think we need that here. Now, Scott was talking about direct command responsibility from Rumsfeld on down for things like the death, the torturing death of Mr. Dilawar in Afghanistan. And there's no doubt that that was a crime, that people should be prosecuted for it. People have been prosecuted for it. There's no doubt in my mind that if you can prove that Donald Rumsfeld or somebody close to him authorized what was done to Mr. Dilawar, intended that it be done, whispered something in somebody's ear saying, do this to people, they should be prosecuted. I'm aware of no evidence. There have been a lot of investigations of this by reporters, by official bodies, by Congress. I'm aware of no shred of evidence that that occurred. Now, was there leakage of authorization of orders for rough treatment of people at Guantanamo that somehow found its way to Afghanistan? Was there some indirect link between the authorizations at the top and some of the bad things that happened at the bottom? I think there probably was, but not an intended link, a link that is bad policy that should be renounced, that should be denounced, but not one that should be prosecuted. Now, I trust Eric Holder, the Attorney General, to have his people look at the detailed facts, and most of them are on the table already, you don't need a grand jury to figure it out, that are available on that, and to reach a responsible conclusion. I don't trust some court-appointed special counsel whose reputation will live or die for the rest of his life or her life to do this when all the incentives are towards harshness. Let's be specific for a minute. I think there's a very strong case to be made that Mr. Al-Qahtani, who you mentioned at Guantanamo, Judge Crawford said he'd been tortured. I think he probably was tortured. You read the monologue of what was done to him, it sure looks like torture to me, probably not severe physical suffering, but severe mental pain or suffering in the fullest sense of the word. But if you read what Rumsfeld authorized and what was done to Al-Qahtani, Rumsfeld authorized certain techniques to be used to Al-Qahtani. They were pretty rough. They were things like 20-hour interrogations, 4 hours forced standing, pulling a hood over his head. I don't think any of them, if you just read that list, look like torture. The people on the ground carried them to huge extremes, and you might want to know whether the people at the top were aware of how far the people on the ground were carrying them. But I think it's worth noting that there were a couple of things on the list of requested techniques sent up from Guantanamo, sent up from the career military at Guantanamo to Rumsfeld for approval. Waterboarding. No, you can't do that. They did it in the CIA. Rumsfeld forbade the use of waterboarding at Guantanamo. Threatening physical harm. No, you can't do that. And there were other things on the list of harshest techniques that they did, and Rumsfeld said no to them all. And later, when the treatment of this one guy at Guantanamo became so shocking, and there were other reasons to see that things were going out of control, Rumsfeld cut back severely. By March of 2003, he'd cut back severely on authorization, and the list of things that that he allowed then is not very frightening. Now, let me give you a little analogy. I mentioned my hypothetical case at the beginning. Here's a real case. It may sound a little familiar. Frankfurt, Germany, 1 October 2002. By the way, that's about the time the Al-Qahtani interrogation was starting. In Frankfurt Police Headquarters, the atmosphere is tense. Deputy Police Chief Wolfgang Deschner is losing patience. On the previous day, his officers arrested one Magnus Gafgen, a 27-year-old law student. He's suspected of having kidnapped an 11-year-old boy, son of a banker. He had collected a 1 million euro ransom payment, but he refused to give police interrogators accurate information. Long interrogation. Finally, the police chief decides to get tough, and he starts threatening the guy and roughing him up a little bit, shaking him, nothing really painful, threatening mainly. And the guy breaks fast, and he says where the kid is. Unfortunately, he's dead by now. He'd buried the body. But what happened thereafter? They did things to this guy in Germany, this citadel of civilization, that Rumsfeld forbade. No threats of physical harm. They threatened this guy with physical harm. It went to the European Court of Human Rights, that bastion of enlightenment, and they basically said, that's okay with us. Now, it's a lot more complicated than what I just presented. But in other words, the practices that Rumsfeld and his general counsel forbade were allowed in Germany and approved, or at least not strongly disapproved, by the European Court of Human Rights. A couple of other points. Scott called the OLC, this is the Justice Department, Supreme Court, people political hacks. Well, I know some of those people, and I think one of them was in there, and I would not call them political hacks. One of them, I think, was an ideologue, an extreme ideologue, John Yoo. He'd been an extreme ideologue for a long time on executive powers. You didn't need Dick Cheney threatening him or promising him something to get him to take an extreme position, and he did take an extreme position. You were told that the interrogation program was approved over the sustained objection of all these career lawyers. Well, some career lawyers approved it. More important, Nancy Pelosi, now the Speaker of the House, was fully briefed on all this, waterboarding, something like 18 briefings on all of the rough techniques that were used by the CIA interrogation program. All of the top people in the Senate Intelligence Committee and House Intelligence Committee, including Nancy Pelosi, now the Speaker, Jane Harman, also of California, Jay Rockefeller, now Chairman of the Senate Intelligence, none of them objected. Harman objected quietly on policy. None of them objected on legal grounds. So if you want to start rounding people up and indicting people, you better haul Nancy Pelosi in too. Extraordinary renditions to torture. The Obama administration looked at the Bush policy on this, which was we'll send people to places, but not if we think they're going to be tortured. They changed nothing. Extraordinary renditions began before the Clinton administration. There were dozens of them during the Clinton administration. They got out of hand during the Bush administration. They will continue under the Obama administration. It's not quite as black and white as you might think. I'll stop there for a while.
Let me have a few, throw in a few points to get things going. One of them, I just want to take a step back from some of the very interesting details you're both providing, and just think about the question of accountability, specifically the question of, you know, the criminality of torture and the notion of the prosecution. And I wanted to just throw out the two reasons why crimes, or the two theories of why crimes are punished. One is to, or prosecuted, is to punish past actions and to deter future actions. Now, are crimes of state comparable to other kinds of crimes? And let's think specifically about the deterrence question. I mean, what is the implication for the future, for generations down, if those, let's just say that the top people responsible for the interrogation and detention policies are actually prosecuted, and will that deter things, or are not prosecuted? How does that play out on the deterrence question? Maybe we'll start with Stuart.
Well, certainly, if you prosecute people, it deters people in the future.
Future leaders.
Yeah, it deters future leaders. They look at what happened to the predecessors. The people who were kind of laying down on the job before 9/11 at the CIA and elsewhere were living in fear, in part, of what the Church Commission did. And they were, you know, they were deterred, and those weren't mainly prosecutions. People are deterred by bad publicity. They're deterred by investigations, because even if you're not prosecuted, you can get bankrupted by the legal fees. And so, sure, there would be deterrence, but there's good deterrence and there's bad deterrence. Let me throw out an example. President Obama has authorized the shooting of numerous Predator missiles from drones into Pakistan to kill suspected Taliban and Al-Qaeda leaders. It's pretty clear that innocent people get killed almost every time you do that, because even if you've got the right guy, they're hanging around civilians. Well, is he a war criminal? If we start branding people who waterboarded Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, by the way, he's the guy who was on film beheading Danny Pearl slowly. If waterboarding that guy is a war crime, what about shooting a Predator drone missile into Pakistan and killing a wife and children along with whoever else you got? You know, the CIA might say, you know, boss, we're not doing this anymore. Do it yourself.
Just take that point and say, is the analogy that he's giving about sort of actions of war versus interrogation, are they analogous, or is there something distinctive about interrogation policy?
Well, in the laws of war, we make very clear distinctions in this area. I mean, the example that Stuart just cited is a clear-cut example of something that is not, in fact, a war crime by any stretch of the imagination. In a war setting, you are entitled to take strikes against a command and control mechanism of your adversary. If you have credible intelligence that there is a command and control figure present at a certain place, you can strike. There's a rule of proportionality that says you're targeting that individual. If it also results in the death of innocent civilians, you should refrain from doing that. That rule of proportionality is not a matter of black and white law. Although, of course, we have people, you know, in the ACLU and the human rights movement who make that argument. That's not accepted as doctrine of law of war by the United States or by other nations. Also, in the area of war crimes prosecutions, we make and have made historically a very strong distinction between discriminate and indiscriminate acts. And if you look at the nature of, you know, war crimes violations that are prosecuted and those that are not prosecuted, generally there's a great aversion to prosecuting acts that occur in the fog of war or on the battlefield, where there's this presumption of broad latitude that's given to military leaders to act to achieve their military objective. In distinction to that, most war crime prosecutions have actually related to persons under detention. And the great thrust of international humanitarian law, of modern laws of war since Abraham Lincoln in 1863, he presented the notion of a principle of discrimination, and he presented the idea that persons taken out of combat, and particularly persons held under your control as prisoners, are subject to special protections. That's a major thrust of the Geneva Conventions and other international law. But before that, it started as a major thrust of American law, like General Order No. 100 from 1863 established that rule. Prosecutions have focused overwhelmingly on mistreatment of individuals in prison. That's the great number. Why? Because we know it's a settled situation. It's removed from the field of war. The authorities are required to maintain order and control, and are required to enforce the rules. And we've seen evolving in law, starting with the United States, a doctrine of almost per se ministerial liability for what goes on in prison camps. So if wrong occurs, there's a duty on the part of the authorities to find it out, investigate it, and prosecute it. If not, the liability for that wrong passes up the chain of command, even if there's no direct evidence of orders having been issued for this wrong to occur. But in this case, I think, we don't even need to rely on that doctrine. The evidence exists. In fact, the flow of evidence has only been obscured over the last 8 years by the invocation of national security classifications to hold it back. This is the reason why we had the Senate Armed Services Committee issue their report. We've seen only a 29-page summary of it. It's a much more detailed report that's prepared that's held back for security classifications reasons, but it concluded, in fact, there's a direct connection between policies formed by the Bush administration and the abuses that occurred on the ground, Abu Ghraib, Bagram, Cropper, Guantanamo, across the board, no real distinction. And I think Stewart points to, you know, a December 2002 order that Rumsfeld issued and then rescinded, in which he makes a number of distinctions. By the way, in that order on the side, he says, with respect to longtime standing being introduced as a technique, which I know from my dealing with the Soviet Union, something that the NKVD and the KGB did, they call it stoika in Russian, by the way, because it's one of the cruelest forms of torture that leaves few physical manifestations. He wrote on the side, you know, why such a limited period? I stand at my desk for 7 hours. What sort of message did, 8 hours actually, yeah. What sort of message did that send to people down the line? I mean, that was actually written on the side, copied, and sent out to people in the field. So the opposite of the message Stewart's given. But aside from that, aside from this December 2002 order, we had still secret rules of engagement issued as early as the beginning of 2002 that were issued to special operations commands. These things still haven't come out, and we know that they came out with the authority of Donald Rumsfeld. There's a great amount of information that yet needs to come out, and I think the push for it to come out is important. But coming back again to this idea of accountability, yeah, there are clear rules that have evolved over time as to which cases get prosecuted and which don't. And in fact, the cases I'm talking about here are the kinds of cases that historically have been prosecuted by the United States. The Predator drone example is totally out of left field, the sort of thing that would never be prosecuted.
Well, I wanted to ask you, during the 1990s, and I want to come to the question of universal jurisdiction, but during the 1990s, in many post-conflict societies, there were all kinds of debates about how we get past the past. What should we do about former tortures? Obviously, in places of throughout Latin America, pervasive torture and killing was, I mean, it was on a horrific scale. But there was a famous debate between two human rights activists. One, José Zalaquet, who was himself a victim of the Chilean regime, and Ari Nair, who had come out of Eastern Europe and at the time was working for Human Rights Watch. José, in the sort of post-conflict moment, and I'm bringing it to the point about how divided Americans are about accountability in the future, José Zalaquet held the position that, you know, society cannot, or victims cannot hold the government hostage. You know, people can't demand accountability simply to satisfy the grievances of victims if, in fact, the larger society wants to just make certain kinds of accommodations or get past things. And Ari Nair had the countervailing point, justice is not democratic. It shouldn't matter what the public thinks. And if the public is out of line with the rule of law, then that should be something that, I mean, his point was that we shouldn't yield to political demands. I wonder if you could just maybe both respond to that, but also just think about why public opinion in this country is literally so divided. Is it as simple as just partisanship, or is there something else? And is justice democratic or not? Would you agree with that or not?
I disagree with him. When the question is whether President Clinton should have been impeached, the public didn't want it. I originally thought he probably should. If the public doesn't want it, they shouldn't do it. Second, but I think more important, it's not going to be done if the public disapproves. But a side point, it amazes me that people like Ari Nair, who understand very well how badly we overuse the criminal sanction in this country with 2.3 million people in prison, and who speak very eloquently about how you shouldn't be prosecuting everybody who takes drugs or, you know, does a shoplifting or whatever. When the question is, when it's people of whom they politically disapprove, they seem to be thirsty for imprisonment, if not blood. And they seem to be oblivious to the fact that there's lots of forms of deterrence short of criminal prosecution. If your reputation had been savaged the way these lawyers we're talking about have been, let alone the top officials, you would be pretty deterred, and anybody following your footsteps would know that even if I don't get sent to prison, I'm going to get called a war criminal, I'm going to be hounded to my grave by these people. Do I really have an important reason to go forward? And if they go forward, it's probably because they had a pretty important reason.
I'll go back to Jonathan Swift for a second. You know, he complained about one of the great problems with justice in our society is the fact that the powerful and the rich go free and they're not held to account. In fact, the way he put it, he said that law is like a cobweb. The gnats and the flies are held by it, but the hornets break free. And he said that was wrong. That's something that fundamentally had to be addressed. And I think when we look at this scandal and how it's evolved, it's a perfect demonstration of that theory and that weakness of our criminal justice system. Not holding to account the powerful, going after the grunts, the little guys. These young soldiers who were both Bagram and at Abu Ghraib were, in fact, court-martialed. And I think in this case, and on this issue, Zalakat and Arya Nair don't disagree. They agree completely that there should be prosecutions. In this case, there should be a criminal investigation in this case. So the distinction, in fact, just doesn't quite work. I think that, you have a criminal investigation. A prosecutor is not going to charge everyone. That's ridiculous. I agree with Stuart about that. There's no way that would happen. The prosecutor is going to select a case, a few cases that present the most clear-cut case in which a prosecution could be collected, and also present the most serious threat to our society and to our values. But to say no, we won't even investigate it, and we won't go after these people because they're powerful and they'll use their political influence and political voice to create political dissension. They'll wreck Washington. They'll bring everything to a standstill. That's the behavior of a 3-year-old. That's not the sort of threat that really should govern our political decisions on matters of importance like this. Now, I want to say one more thing on this, and that is with respect to law of war prosecutions, there's another consideration that weighs in that says public opinion matters. And I go back to Francis Lieber, who's a professor at Columbia University, who was asked by the Lincoln administration towards the end of the Civil War, look at whether or not we should prosecute the leaders of the Confederacy for war crimes. He'd actually given a speech in New York in which he'd advocated that. And he got the archives, he examined them together with a couple of other faculty members at Columbia, and they came out with a recommendation at the end. And they said, actually, don't do it. And here's why. The real consideration at the end of the day is respect for the laws of war. And we have to ask, is the prosecution going to advance that respect or not? And so, in looking at this, it's important that the public feel this is the right thing to do. Not every person in the public, but there be broad appreciation of this. And that we have a case that's clear and strong and will lead to a conviction. These are points that Stuart made. I agree. Those are important factors. They're factors that the prosecutor has to weigh in at the end in making his decision. But that happens after we have a complete investigation, after the public is fully informed about what was found, and after a prosecutor is able to exercise a judgment based on the evidence he's put together.
Could I just quickly respond? You mentioned conviction. I think one reason there shouldn't be prosecutions here, unless the evidence turns out differently than I expect, is that there would be no conviction. Prosecutors aren't supposed to bring cases they can't win. I've spoken to experienced criminal lawyers who are quite confident that, based on the facts that have been put to light so far, no high-level official could be convicted because they have valid defenses, not to mention jury sympathy by some jurors. But I think we're losing sight of one point, which is that Scott makes it sound a little bit as though I'm against any criminal investigation. I hope I've made it clear. I trust President Obama and Attorney General Holder to conduct an appropriate criminal investigation, and I suspect that they'll do that. They not only have criticized harshly this administration, Holder has called waterboarding torture in his confirmation hearing. They have nothing to gain from protecting the Bush people unless they think it would be bad for the country to prosecute the Bush people, and if that is part of their thinking, I submit who in the world is better qualified to have that thought than President Obama and Attorney General Holder. And Scott, it sounds as though you don't trust them to do the right thing. You want to have an independent special counsel, an independent commission, somebody to take it out of the usual Justice Department process, somebody to take it out of the usual criminal investigation, and have an extraordinary sort of get them process.
No, I completely disagree with that. You're mischaracterizing what I said. I believe they should follow appropriate Department of Justice process, and that would lead to the appointment of the special prosecutor.
No, that's not
because
routine.
In cases where the Department of Justice itself is involved in the investigation, an outsider comes in. And this investigation is going to turn on what happened inside the Office of Legal Counsel at the top of the criminal division. It's going to focus on things that happened inside the Department of Justice, not only involving Bush administration appointees. That requires someone from outside the department to conduct it. That's the Department of Justice's own ethics rules. So I think if Eric Holder applies these rules...
Is implicated here? Who in the Justice Department who is not a Bush appointee is implicated here?
Career employees from OLC were involved in the preparation of many of these memoranda and were involved in the advice that was given by the criminal division. But in any event, that's an issue that has to be investigated, doesn't it? You think the Justice Department is going to investigate itself and that's going to be credible?
I think the Obama administration would not shrink from investigating the abuses of the Bush administration if they think there's criminality. And I don't think they'd be deterred because somewhere there's a career appointee still hanging around the Justice Department who might have been implicated somewhat in this. There's been no publicity that I've seen ever suggesting that that the decisions were made at the career appointee level that we're talking about.
Okay. Now, I'm going to ask one more question, but let's ask everybody who has questions to pass them to the sides and the folks will come down to pick them up from you. I want to ask about the question of universal jurisdiction and the Pinochet precedent. Whatever happens in the United States, and as it's shaped by domestic considerations, torture is an international crime, and there are no reasons why, for example, there's 20 countries that have universal jurisdiction laws, why they would be worried about what public attitudes in the United States are. But there are obviously the political issues connecting to the power of the United States. What do you think about the question of U.S. officials being prosecuted, top-ranking officials being prosecuted in Europe? Would it be good or bad? Would it be likely? What do you think the scenarios might be? Scott?
Well, I'd just start by saying it's not a hypothetical. In fact, the investigations are already open. There's in fact, a criminal case already open in Italy involving 26 American officials, intelligence officers, a career diplomat, a military attaché, and the examining magistrate who's presenting that case, probably the most famous prosecutor in Italy, I've interviewed twice, has, you know, openly said that, you know, his investigation's not closed. And after the conclusion of the Bush administration, of course, they would consider also extending the case to include the policymakers on up the line. And similarly, we know there's an open criminal investigation in Spain that followed the decision of the Spanish Supreme Court about two Spanish citizens who had been incarcerated in Guantanamo. By the way, that fact pattern matches perfectly what happened in the Pinochet case, where, of course, jurisdiction was exercised by the Audiencia Nacional in Spain because of Spanish citizens who were held and were tortured in Santiago. That's what gave jurisdiction. In fact, we've got the same prosecutor in Spain handling that case who handled the Pinochet case. Mm-hmm. And he's been collecting information to potentially bring charges against American figures as well. So is it possible? Yes. And under the European Union Agreement on Extradition, it covers 25 countries, not just Spain and Italy. So an American official, former official, landing in any of those 25 countries would be subject to the arrest request issued by either of these magistrates. So is it a potential problem? Yes, one. Two, When would they do this? Very clear from both of these magistrates that in their view of universal jurisdiction, quite correctly, I think, the first responsibility to undertake criminal inquiry and criminal action rests with the United States. So they're very keen to see what will the United States do. And if the United States acts in the way it is in fact legally obligated to act by opening the criminal investigation, they're not going to do anything. They'll leave it to the United States to act. If the United States does not, or if immunity is granted, well, then we'll see what happens. But I think it's certainly conceivable that the Pinochet example could be followed exactly. That is, John Yoo decides to take a vacation trip to Italy. He would have a very unpleasant surprise upon arrival at the airport there, probably.
He had to cancel his Fulbright to
Italy. And indeed, he already did when he heard about the open criminal case. So is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? It's a bad thing, in my view, because the United States, as a leader of the international community, wanting to assert itself and prove its leading position, needs to enforce the law. And that includes the Convention Against Torture, an American convention, essentially, which I got the back of the hand from the past administration. It should be taken seriously, it should be enforced, and that means criminal investigation.
Now, quickly, I'll respond. Mm-hmm. I think these international tribunals and a lot of the European tribunals are highly politicized, and I'll give you a couple of examples, and not to be trusted. Balthazar Garzon, who got a lot of great publicity over the grabbing of Pinochet, or whatever he did with Pinochet, the Spanish magistrate, was quoted in an interesting interview about why he would like to prosecute officials of the Bush administration if he could get his hands on them. But this was not lately about torture. This was in late 2001. The Bush administration was talking about bombing Afghanistan in the wake of 9/11 because that's where al-Qaeda was. Balthazar Garzon thought it was a war crime for the Bush administration to be talking about bombing Afghanistan. If you trust this man with anything, you have a lot finer sense of trust than I do. The International Court for Former Yugoslavia, another international tribunal, they open an investigation into whether the Clinton administration should be prosecuted for bombing Kosovo and Bosnia in order to prevent the ethnic cleansing there. You know, their idea was disproportionate deaths, too many civilian deaths. Does that sound familiar? Oh, nobody ever gets prosecuted for that, Scott said, but the International Court for Former Yugoslavia, the prosecutor at least thought it worth investigating.
He didn't prosecute. Did not.
But he started down the road, and it was ludicrous for him to start down the road. If he'll start down the road for a ludicrous reason like that, what would it take for him to keep going down the road? Now, last point, I trust the hypocrisy of the Europeans on this. The European Court of Human Rights, for example, gave a pass to that German guy who was starting to beat on the child killer. And in the leading precedent of the European Court of Human Rights, Ireland versus United Kingdom, 1978, the court ruled that the following methods used on IRA captives by the British were not torture. They may sound familiar to you. Forcing suspects to stand on their toes against the wall with fingers high above their heads. That's one of the things that has been called torture when Rumsfeld authorized it. Keeping dark hoods over their heads, again, Rumsfeld. Assailing them with loud and hissing noises, depriving them of sleep, food, and drink. Now, in that context, the European Court of Human Rights was saying, not torture. But if you let somebody like this character, Balthazar Garzon, loose, Lord knows what he'd say was torture.
Well, you completely mischaracterized what the European Court of Human Rights said to start with. First of all, they said it was not torture, it was cruel, inhuman, and degrading conduct, right? First point. Second point, they subsequently reversed their view on those matters and concluded that these practices were torture, something I think that would be useful to point out to this audience. And what's the source for this? This is an argument John Yoo made in his memorandum, which the Justice Department reversed, withdrew. It was completely misleading. I'm sort of astounded that you rely on John Yoo.
The source for this is the opinion of the European Court of Human Rights. Now, yes, they held it was cruel, inhuman, and degrading, but cruel, inhuman, and degrading is not a crime under U.S. law. And therefore, for our purposes, it's not particularly relevant.
Really? Okay.
Okay.
Well, do you want to prosecute Americans for matters that are not crimes under U.S. law?
I think they should be prosecuted for crimes under U.S. law. And I think these techniques, depending on how they're used and in combination, very well may be crimes under U.S. law.
Okay, well, we got some excellent questions. A number of them make some of the same points. Well, I picked out some of the ones that hit different topics than have necessarily been asked. But Scott, someone is asking something that, drawing on the German example, in a sense, analogizing it to the more, the nuclear weapon question. If you believe that the only way to obtain information from a terrorist who had planted a nuclear bomb in New York were to waterboard him, would you support waterboarding in this case?
So yeah, well, that's like front-loading everything with the assumption that the real world is the world of Fox Television's 24, which is preposterous nonsense.
Okay,
even in California, it's preposterous nonsense. And I'll cite as my authority Kiefer Sutherland, the actor who plays Jack Bauer, who says anybody who actually believes this is crazy. The point that we should be focused on is, what are effective interrogation methods? And the supposition that the instant resort to violence and brutality gets you everything you need and gets the truth and allows you to save someone is bunk. It's insulting to our intelligence to put that forward. There are very effective interrogation techniques that can be used. And in your hypothetical, for instance, with the child who's been seized, the thing we should be looking for is a competent interrogator who knows how to get to the bottom of the facts and do it efficiently. And beating the guy isn't, in fact, going to be the most efficient way to get the truth. And the FBI, I think, has got 30 years of experience that tells you how you go about this and how you do it. It's having trained interrogators who know how to do it and know how to get a response and do it quickly. That's what we should be pushing for.
Okay. Well, speaking of the FBI, Stuart, I'll direct this one to you. Here's an excellent question. The FBI was one of the first entities to expose and report the use of torture in Iraq, actually also in Guantanamo, and the fact that it generally fails to produce credible intelligence. In spite of their laudable actions in doing this, does the FBI share in the blame for allowing the use of torture to continue? Or how would you read the role of the FBI?
I think the FBI...
Stuart, your mic's on.
Oh, there it is. Okay, thank you. Yes, we'd like.
Hello?
Good.
The FBI has consistently opposed torture and all rough interrogation methods throughout. So, no, they're not complicit. I mean, whatever you think about what was done to people, the FBI is not complicit. Now, a secondary aspect of the question is, well, should we believe, because many FBI agents have said coercion doesn't work, our gentle ways of doing things work, that should you believe them because they say it? And there's a fair amount of evidence to the contrary of what they say. They're in a culture, and it's a good culture for law enforcement, where they don't ever coerce prisoners, period. Miranda rights. I think that's fine for domestic law. When you're talking about terrorists who are capable of inflicting massive casualties on the United States, and in rare occasions, no, I don't think anybody seriously advocates coercion as a routine interrogation method. What some people do advocate is when you've been talking to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed for 3 weeks and you've tried everything and he's laughing at you and you think there may be an attack coming soon that he knows about how to stop it, should you then use not necessarily torture, but should you use harsher methods than the FBI uses? That's the real question. The FBI, by and large, says that's not what we do. That's what the CIA does. We don't like it.
Okay, thank you.
One thing I would just want to point out there, important, that the FBI agents who noted the abuse in Guantanamo opened a criminal investigation. They opened the file. They recommended the investigation. That's process working the way it should. And what happened? We learned from the Inspector General's report into this that a political appointee who would have been a target of the investigation at the end intervened and ordered a closing of the file. There's been political intervention here continuously to stop criminal investigation. Just a minor point.
Well, I think if your point is that you don't trust the Bush administration to investigate the Bush administration, I would not debate it. If your point is that you don't trust the Obama administration to investigate the Bush administration, I respectfully disagree. I trust them.
This also is a question for Stuart, but perhaps both of you. You said that Bush, Rumsfeld, et cetera, didn't authorize grotesque tortures, but isn't that exactly what they did with the authorization of extraordinary rendition? So maybe you could just speak to specifically to the issue of extraordinary rendition. Right.
I think they got extraordinary renditions clearly got out of hand, and some people were horribly tortured, were sent by our forces to Syria, a guy named Arar, and horribly tortured, and it's deplorable, and we ought to be paying them reparations. And it's possible that somebody ought to be prosecuted for it. But let's put this in a little perspective. The Bush administration did not invent extraordinary renditions. There were dozens of them done during the Clinton administration. The typical attitude was not we're sending this guy to Syria to be tortured. It's that this guy's a Syrian. We're sending him to Syria because they have pending criminal charges against him, and we want him taken off the street because he's dangerous. That's the kind of the original idea. And Al Gore was once in a meeting in the White House where Lloyd Cutler, my old friend, the White House counsel, was saying, oh, no, we can't do that to this guy because, you know, it violates international law. Al Gore said, of course it violates international law. That's why it's a secret. Go grab his ass. You know, that's what we do. Now, in the Bush administration, two things changed. Three, maybe. They did a lot of extraordinary renditions. They started getting careless about whether they had the guy they thought they had or not, and they certainly were careless about how these people were going to be treated when they got where they were going to go. For that, you know, I think that I'd severely criticize them for that. I hope the Obama administration will cut back on that. I believe they will, and that they'll return it to what it was in the Clinton administration, which is about right.
Here's another question for Stuart. Who are the people in the Bush administration you think have already been punished enough, and who should we feel sorry for?
Well, how about Colin Powell? He approved, I think there are those who think Colin Powell's a war criminal. I think a lot of us find that idea a little hard to swallow. Colin Powell knew about waterboarding. I don't think he's a war criminal. I feel sorry for him probably isn't the way I would phrase it. I don't believe that Nancy Pelosi is a war criminal because she was notified about waterboarding. And I don't think any of the people who did that were war criminals because they all approved the same things. The entire top echelon of the Bush administration approved these methods. That's one reason an investigation, a big investigation to find out the facts. We know a lot of the most important facts. If, you know, we know the waterboarding is what it is, that a lot of people think it's torture, and we know they approved it. The question is what do you do with that?
Okay.
You know, I can just say something on that same point, I think. First of all, we need the investigation to establish who was involved and who participated in these decisions and what they said and what they did. We really don't know. I mean, we've heard there were principal committee meetings at which things were approved and discussed. You know, we've heard Colin Powell was involved with them. We don't know the full story of what happened and what was said at that meeting. We need to know that. It's extremely important before we rush to judgments, including about who should be charged and who is culpable. The business about Nancy Pelosi, frankly, is ridiculous. Let's just stop. By the way, I believe the investigation really needs to include a look at congressional oversight, which I think failed catastrophically here. Congress has a duty under the Constitution to keep an eye on all these things. It didn't do that. And I think they all richly deserve to be embarrassed based on that. And we need to know how they were briefed and what they did in response. But to say that members of the Gang of Eight, as they call it, who were given briefings about what happened, acquiesced, approved what was done. That's absurd. They were briefed about what happened. How were they briefed? What were they told? And you're going to get different accounts of what they were told and in what detail. But my understanding is they were told that certain approaches were being used, and these things had all been vetted and approved by the lawyers, so you really don't need to worry your silly little head. I think they're guilty, above all, of failure to inquire into this, failure to fully expose what went on, and failure to act on it. Right? But that's not the same thing as making the affirmative decision to do these things and implement it. Those are totally different.
I agree it's not the same thing, but I think you're trying to have it both ways. When you treat it as irrelevant, that even that just about everybody who was told about this, including the people in the legislative branch, including the Democratic leaders, some of whom are now denouncing it, knew what happened, and there's no doubt she knew what happened. It's been written 1,000 times that she was briefed repeatedly in detail on waterboarding. Porter Goss, the former director, has said that publicly. She's never denied it. She would deny it if it weren't true. Now, of course, I'm not saying that she's in the same league with the people who ordered it. She's in a different league, but it's relevant. When you're in 2002, you're in the wake of this terrorist attack, and everybody in the room, without a single dissent, at the top, is agreeing on a certain course of action, I think we should be a little hesitant to second-guess them and think of them as a bunch of war criminals.
Let me ask one last question, and then unless you want to fold your final comments in, but someone asked the question of, and given your differing views, what can and should citizens do to, you know, at this moment, at this juncture? What do you think is the role of the citizenry in terms of whatever you envision the ideal outcome or the preferable outcome to be?
Well, you know, I think it's critical, in fact, that citizens pay attention to this issue. As I said, I think, in fact, I agree very strongly with John McCain on this point. He said, this is a definitional issue for us today. It is. He was absolutely right. His leadership on a lot of these issues also was really noble, and I think shows that this is not something that's like a Democratic-Republican divide. In fact, all three of the finalist candidates on the Republican side had rejected the torture program. I think it's important that we overcome these political divisions, that we restore the consensus that our country as a democratic society had, that rests on views and positions that were taken by George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, minor league U.S. president, of course, compared to George W. Bush, about torture and our rejection of torture. It was a definitional value for our country. It needs to continue to be something that defines us. We need to continue to push this issue. We need to continue to push for the truth. So I think the first thing is getting out all the facts, insisting that we learn what happened in detail. I think that means supporting a commission that will get this out, also supporting congressional hearings that will bring it out, pressuring the Obama administration to publish these OLC opinions, which even its transition team could not obtain. And I think, yes, it also means reminding this administration that it has an obligation to conduct a criminal investigation.
It's a good question, and I think that people who are motivated, it takes a lot of time to learn the facts of this, because the first fact that I would submit is that you should be very skeptical of what you read in the newspapers and see on TV. I think the coverage has been very one-sided. If you want to get a balanced view of what happened, and you can start with that, you should read Jack Goldsmith's book, The Terror Presidency. He's the guy who withdrew the initial torture memo and rather heroically led an internal rebellion in the Justice Department against what he thought were some lawless actions by President Bush and his superiors. But he wrote a very thoughtful book, The Terror Presidency, after he left, and it denounces properly what he denounces, but as he writes in his book and elsewhere, the idea of prosecuting these people is huge overreaction. You should read Philip Bobbitt's Terror and Consent. You should read Benjamin Wittes's The Wars Against Terror. I may have the title there wrong. But basically, you need to educate yourself beyond the usual news sources. There is a heck of a lot of information out there. I think what a citizen needs to form his own judgment, 90%, 95% of the information you need is out there. What could be ferreted out by a criminal by an investigation is, you know, might be relevant to whether so-and-so ought to be prosecuted or not, but it's not relevant to the big questions we're talking about of policy looking forward. And I think that you should look to the Obama administration to set better policies going forward, and I think they will.
Okay. Well, let me just give you both a chance to have any final comments, brief comments to wrap up. And I do think that you probably satisfied Arthur Roop's desire to see a little bit of fireworks. Now is the chance to really go out in a blaze if you so choose.
Well, maybe I'll just continue with the book list since we seem to be peddling a lot of books here.
But, you know, I'd start by noting that Jack Goldsmith, who's a friend of mine and who I like genuinely, also served as one of the lawyers in the War Council at the heart of this. And in fact, his work and things he did would be one of the major subjects of the investigation. He also authored a number of memoranda counseling and advocating things that are violations of international humanitarian law, point that he now seems to recognize. And we don't know everything he did in the Justice Department, but we know, of course, he is very, very close and ideologically connected with figures who would be right in the crosshairs of an investigation here. But I'd recommend a different set of books, and I think I'd start right now with Bart Gellman's book, Angler, which is all about the Cheney vice presidency, in which he talks about Cheney's advocacy of torture, his decision that this was a great thing. He'd seen it in Egypt. He loved it. And he thought, why aren't our people using these dark arts? He pushed it through progressively, step by step, principally with the assistance of David Addington, great portrait of all of this. And Angler. And second, I would say my friend Jane Mayer's book, Dark Side, which shows the development of these policies within the administration and then their implementation in fairly graphic and detailed terms. And third, I'd say, in order to get a serious look at what Stewart calls the gentler methods of the FBI, which I call the effective methods of the FBI, which are not remotely gentle, I'd recommend that you read Major Matthew Alexander's How to Break a Terrorist. Matthew Alexander, who I know very well and think and greatly admire, was a career law enforcement professional and also an Air Force officer, and he led the intelligence crew in Iraq that identified the location and effectively took out al-Zarqawi, the head of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And he describes in great detail exactly how this was done using FBI methods, working with a team of people, by the way, who used the rough stuff and found repeatedly that it didn't work and didn't go anywhere. And they would constantly turn people over to him after they gave up, not getting anything. He'd use these coddling FBI methods, which I have to say would scare the bejesus out of me if they were applied to me. And he got results very quickly, sometimes in 2 hours, 3 hours, 6 hours. And he, in fact, got the results that took out al-Zarqawi, so critical development. But in the end, this is all about democracy. It's about our democracy, and it's about the rule of law. And are we going to have a government where the big, powerful figures, the president, people in the National Security Council, legal advisors to the president, are able to twist and turn and deface the law and do whatever they want? Because they can hire John Yoo and he'll craft whatever OLC opinion they want. That, just as Swift says, tells us that black is white. Is that the sort of country we want? Are we just going to accept that? The peril to us and our understanding of our democracy is grave if we accept that.
Last word.
I'll refrain from rhetoric, and let's go to some facts. And the facts I'd like to address is one little aspect of this that I think is often mistakenly described, and has been tonight by Scott, the idea that coercive methods never get useful intelligence. This is kind of a mantra of the human rights groups, and it sure makes it easy, right? Why would anybody ever dream of yelling at a captive or of threatening him with something, let alone something really harsh, if it didn't ever work? You'd have to be a lunatic or a sadist to do that. The reason that people are tempted to go beyond the FBI, so I guess I'm not supposed to call them gentle methods. They call them rapport-building methods. The reason why people go beyond them sometimes is that they think they can get life-saving information that they couldn't get any other way. And let me read a couple of examples. Chris Mackey wrote with a co-author, Greg Miller. He was using mildly coercive methods as an army interrogator in Afghanistan. Quote, "The early story of the war in Afghanistan was one of frustration and failure for us. Many al-Qaeda prisoners had been trained to resist, and our schoolhouse methods were woefully out of date. Later, our experience in Afghanistan showed that the harsher methods we used, though they never contravened the Geneva Conventions, let alone crossed over into torture, the harsher the methods, the better information we got, and the sooner we got it." Mackey said they never touched anyone, rather their main methods were threats to hand over people to their home country's brutal intelligence services and sleep deprivation, limited by threats, not doing it, threats, limited by a rule that the interrogator must stay awake as long as the prisoner. The European Court of Human Rights decision I mentioned in 78, and it did say, yes, cruel and human degrading, but not torture. They also said this. The methods that they were assessing were effective, they said, at the same time they were disapproving of them as cruel and human degrading, in obtaining, quote, "a considerable amount of intelligence information, including the identification of 700 members of both IRA factions and the discovery of individual responsibility for about 85 previously unexplained criminal incidents." And the other I'll mention briefly, Israel's Supreme Court, High Court of Justice, in 1999 banned what they called moderate physical pressure, which were methods somewhere in between FBI style and real torture. Some would call them torture. I wouldn't. The Israeli High Court of Justice said in the process of outlawing these methods that they never questioned these methods' effectiveness. Indeed, it said coercion, quote, "has led to the thwarting of murderous attack," and cited several cases in which interrogators had obtained life-saving intelligence. For example, an applicant who complained of Israeli torture had admitted under interrogation that he was involved in numerous terrorist activities in the course of which many Israeli citizens were killed, including the bombing of the Cafe Apropos in Tel Aviv, in which three women were murdered and 30 people were injured. A powerful explosive device identical to the one detonated at the Cafe Apropos was found in the applicant's village. In other words, the ticking time bomb incident happens sometimes, not very often. Uncovering this explosive device thwarted an attack similar to the one at Cafe Apropos. Now, the Israeli Supreme Court said you can't do this anymore, but guess what? They still do it, and the Israeli Supreme Court has found ways not to punish the doing of it.
Okay. Well, thank you both very much. You've given us a lot to think about and debate among ourselves. Thank you. Thanks so much.
Great.
Great.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.